At 11 o'clock in the morning, a technician at the Monmouth Radar School had been demonstrating the latest tracking equipment to a group of military VIPs. Capable of automatically painting a target, the new device could track the fastest jets. But when it locked on a low-flying object 2.5 miles east of the radar station, the set immediately kicked back into manual operation. The operator again switched the set to automatic, and again, the set kicked back to manual. For 3 minutes the target remained in range as the radar operator frantically tried to force the set to track it automatically, and the set refused to respond. Finally, the embarrassed technician turned to the VIPs gathered around the scope and said, "It's going too fast for the set." In the vicinity less than a half hour later, the pilot of a T-33 jet trainer, with an Air Force major on board, saw flying below him a disc 30 to 50 feet in diameter and silver in color. As he rolled the T-33 and dived toward the disc, the silvery object stopped, hovered for a few moments, then accelerated heading south, and without slowing, made a D-120-degree turn and disappeared out over the ocean. Immediately, the director of Air Force Intelligence saw the new UFO project and assigned Captain Edward Ruppelt as its head. Later in his book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, Ruppelt wrote that when he arrived at Air Technical Intelligence Command he was told, "The powers that be are anti-flying saucer, and to stay in favor, it behooves one to follow suit, a carryover from the mindset of grudge personnel." Ruppelt described them as schizophrenic, officially laughing at the UFO reports coming in, and individually, in private, defending the phenomenon. Grudge became Project Blue Book in early 1952, and the reports trickling in each month increased to about 20. In April, they jumped to 99. The following month, the Secretary of the Air Force said in a press statement, "No concrete evidence has yet reached us either to prove or disprove the existence of the so-called flying saucers. There remain, however, a number of sightings that the Air Force investigators have been unable to explain." Then at 11:40 on the night of July 19, 1952, seven objects suddenly appeared on the radar screen at Washington National Airport, 3 miles south of the nation's capital. The seven green blips cruised through forbidden air corridors, moving slowly across the radar screen at 100 to 130 miles an hour. Suddenly, two of the objects accelerated to tremendous speed and almost instantaneously flew beyond the range of the radar, a distance of 100 miles. Four radar controllers agreed that nothing like an airplane could cause the blips on the scope. Then, to other radar centers, one at nearby Andrews Air Force Base, called in. Painted on their scopes, they had the same targets performing the same speed bursts. And now the targets had moved into every quadrant on the scope and were flying in prohibited airways over the White House and the Capitol. One of the targets had been clocked at 7,000 miles an hour. As airline pilots in the vicinity radioed that they were being followed by unknown aircraft or that the aircraft suddenly seemed to be leaving, the luminescent blips on ground radar would appear or trail away. In the early hours after midnight, the most powerful of the radar installations, located at Washington National Airport, radioed the operators at Andrews that one target appeared to be hovering directly above them. When the operators rushed out and looked up, they saw a huge fiery orange sphere. And then, all of the objects disappeared. 1 week later, the same radar controllers locked again on the mysterious objects. This time, the objects formed a wide arc around Washington, and the controllers called in two F-94 interceptors, which arrived just after midnight. But when the jets appeared on the radar screens, the targets suddenly disappeared. The jets returned to base. As soon as the jets departed, the targets appeared once again. In the interim, Langley Air Force Base in Virginia had received calls of bright lights in the sky, rotating and giving off alternation colors. The Air Force scrambled another F-94 from Langley and the pilot made visual contact with one of the lights, but as he closed on it, it suddenly disappeared, like somebody turning off a light bulb. The radar operator in the F-94 made contact three more times, but each time, contact was broken as the strange object apparently accelerated out of range within seconds. A few minutes after the object broke radar contact for the last time, the green blips appeared again en masse on the radar screens at Washington National Airport. The Air Force scrambled two more jets, and this time, the targets remained stationary so the radar controllers could monitor both their movements and those of the jets as they came onto the screen. But when the pilots themselves closed in for visual contact, the objects sped away. Finally, one of the pilots saw a light hovering in exactly the position radioed in by one of the radar controllers. He flew closer, and the light remained motionless. Then, he cut in the afterburner and rapidly closed, but moments before he would have overtaken the light suddenly blinked off, and the pilot found himself traveling at Mach 1 speed into a black sky. 3 days later, the Air Force held a press conference at the Pentagon, the largest and the longest since World War II. Before taking questions from the press, Major General John A. Samford, Director of Intelligence, pointed out that of the 1,000 to 2,000 reports investigated by the Air Force to date, the bulk could be attributed to either friendly aircraft erroneously recognized or reported hoaxes, quite a few of those, electronic and meteorological phenomena of one sort or another, light aberrations, and many other things. However, he continued, there have remained a percentage of this total, in the order of 20% of the reports, that have come from credible observers of relatively incredible things. We keep on being concerned about them. One of the press corps asked how the radar controllers on the previous two Saturday nights had interpreted the blips on the radar screen. Samford replied, they said they saw good returns. But, he pointed out, this did not necessarily mean the objects had to be solid body aircraft. Birds could give off good returns. Radar could even bounce off invisible temperature inversions, hit a ground target, and show up as a blip on the screen. But Samford's aide, an expert on radar, was not sure how that theory accounted for the sudden disappearances and reappearances of the targets, or the incredible speeds at which they seemed to travel. Nor did it explain the visual corroboration of several airline pilots in the air at the time. When another reporter asked Samford his opinion of the temperature inversion theory, he responded, "My own mind is satisfied with that explanation." But he also felt they should continue their research, that the objects were probably some sort of phenomenon that science would someday be able to explain. Personally, because of their apparent ability to change direction and speed instantaneously, Samford felt the objects were not material. Late in the press conference, a reporter asked Samford if he could state unequivocally that none of the strange flying craft observed during the previous 5 years had actually been ultra-secret military weapons. Samford replied it was always possible that an observer had mistaken a jet fighter for a flying saucer. What I was aiming at, said the reporter, was this popular feeling of mystery? Interjected Samford. Of mystery, said the reporter. Of something. That it's some very highly secret new weapon that we're working on that's causing all this. Samford chortled. We have nothing that has no mass and unlimited power. And everyone laughed. By the end of 1952, 1,501, or nearly twice as many sightings as each of the previous 5 years combined, had been reported, and over 300 of these remained unexplained. While exploring every angle of the mere case they could think to explore, the Elders and Welch began a search through campus libraries at the University of Arizona and Arizona State for information on the star cluster Mir claimed to be the home of his extraterrestrial visitors, the Pleiades. In an investigation like this, said Welch, 9 out of 10 times you're presupposing it's a hoax because that's the way you're testing, that's the way you're interrogating. But let's suppose for a moment that it's real. Then we ask, if this is true, were there other Billy Mays in the past? We began at that point, and what popped up in a couple of weeks is what I call the Pleiadian connection. With the help of Lee Elder's sister and several friends in California and the East, they searched through libraries and second-hand bookstores for hundreds of books, magazine articles, trade journals, and doctoral theses at various universities. What was startling was a consistency, said Welch. From an astronomical point of view, you're talking about an extremely young, extremely insignificant system of stars. Yet at different parts of the globe, many times simultaneously, many times a thousand years apart, history and mythology mention the Pleiades and their importance. They're noted as being the source of knowledge in the rice culture in Asia and in the potato culture in Europe and South America. These societies attributed their knowledge to a series of events in mythological form involving messengers from the Pleiades. Why in so many times, in so many parts of the world, are the references similar? Why all this energy towards the Pleiades? They're revered, they're looked at as the center of heaven, and they're looked at as a source of ancestry and wisdom and guidance. Though other stars and star groups are mentioned in history, to the surprise of Welch and the elders, the frequency of reference to the Pleiades seemed to exceed that of its closest rival, Orion, by nearly 10 times. When they had collected every mention of the seven stars they could find, Welch and the elders had scores of references to the Pleiades and their importance in cultures all over the world and from all periods of history, including three from the Bible. The Book of Job spoke of their sweet influences. But Welch wondered if perhaps Meyer himself had conducted the same research in Swiss and German libraries. My first thought was, what are the odds of him doing that very thing? But a lot of these connections were not readily available, you had to be looking for them. So if you picked a star system and said, let me see if I can find something on that, you're talking about quite a bit of research before you come across the Pleiades. At one point, I remember us all sitting down kind of tired, when Del was up from Tucson at the time. It was late at night, and we were talking about some of the connections that each of us had separately discovered. And we're sitting there with, oh, it must have been about 7 or 8 legal-sized pages front and back of noted connections we'd come across. And somebody said, God, we've spent over 1,000 hours on this already and it seems like we've just begun. A tight cluster of several thousand stars, the Pleiades lie in the constellation Taurus, nearly 500 light-years from Earth. The principal stars shine bluish-white and radiate intensely, illuminating surrounding clouds of gas. The Pleiades are young, too young for intelligent life to have evolved. But Meyer had repeated specifically that the Pleiadians had not originated there, only that they had migrated to the Pleiades after engineering a planet to their liking. Early civilizations recorded that the seven brightest stars were once visible to the naked eye, though today only 6 can be seen. Aligned with nearby Orion's belt, the Pleiades are often mistaken for the Little Dipper, but their configuration is far more compact and appears to be enshrouded in a gossamer haze, one that inspired Tennyson to describe them as looking like a swarm of fireflies tangled in a silver braid. Of all the stars in this beautiful swarm, Alcyone is the brightest, shining with a brilliance 1,000 times greater than our sun. In Star Lore of All Ages, published in 1911, William Olcott wrote, "No group of stars known to astronomy has excited such universal attention as the little cluster of faint stars we know as the Pleiades. In all ages of the world's history, they have been admired and critically observed. Great temples have been reared in their honor. Mighty nations have worshipped them, and people far removed from each other have been guided in their agricultural and commercial affairs by the rising and setting of these 6 close-set stars. This little group, twinkling so timidly in the nights of autumn in the eastern heavens, links the races of mankind in closer relationship than any bond save nature's. No wonder that they have inspired universal awe and admiration, that within this group of suns, man has sought to find the very center of the universe. Legends from pre-Inca peoples living in Peru speak of inhabited stars and gods who visited them from the Pleiades. The astronomical writings of China mention the Pleiades as early as 2357 BC, worshipped by young women as the seven sisters of industry. The Greeks aligned temples with their rising and setting. In Egypt, on the first day of spring, the south passageway of the Great Pyramid perfectly framed the Pleiades, Some scholars even maintain that the seven chambers of this enormous monument were inspired by the cluster's seven visible stars. May Day and the Japanese Fest of Lanterns are remnants of ancient rites in honor of the Pleiades. The Hopi call the star cluster Chuhokan, home of our ancestors. And Navajo legend holds that men arrived on Earth from the stars, particularly the Pleiades, and that we continued to be visited by our celestial relatives. Attempting to explain the seeming coincidences between customs of ancient cultures and those of more modern societies, R.G. Halliburton wrote in Nature magazine in 1881 of the universal reverence for the Pleiades. He noted that the Samoans of the South Pacific called their sacred bird the bird of the Pleiades, and that the Berbers of Morocco claimed that paradise lay in the heavens circumscribed by the cluster. Halliburton concluded his article, "Even if the theory of prehistoric astronomers and of some modern men of science, that the Pleiades are the center of the universe, should prove to be unfounded, I am persuaded that the day is coming when the learned will admit that those stars are the central sun of the religions, calendars, myths, traditions, and symbolism of early ages." Agnes Clarke, in The System of the Stars, written in 1907, called the Pleiades the meeting place in the skies of mythology and science. The vivid and picturesque aspect of these stars riveted, from the earliest ages, the attention of mankind, a peculiar sacredness attached to them, and their concern with human destinies was believed to be intimate and direct. Though the Pleiades form little more than a speck in the visible night sky, no other star group has been mentioned as frequently in the literature and mythology of world cultures for the past 2.5 millennia. And in every instance, the tiny cluster of seven was portrayed as female, the sisters, the virgins, the maidens, the goddesses. Jay puzzled over how to analyze the mere evidence and how to capture the scientists and their work on film. John Stefani had looked for a consultant. In Phoenix, he located a sound and light technician, Jim Dilatoso. Short, gaunt, and mercurial, the 28-year-old Dilatoso was involved in myriad projects in the entertainment industry, staging sound and light shows with lasers, computers, and sound digitizers. A friend had recommended him because the young technician had been a part-time consultant for a documentary film on the testing of the Shroud of Turin, the 2,000-year-old funeral sheet that purportedly had covered the body of the crucified Christ. Stefani wanted to subject the mere photos to the same computerized image analysis as that performed on the Shroud. At their first meeting, Stefani showed Dilatoso six of the photographs of extraterrestrial spacecraft allegedly taken by Mir. "Good special effects," thought Dilatoso. "I was trying to figure out how I would make them. Couldn't be models because of the properties of the edges and the reflective surface. No, I'd build a rigid structure out of aluminum or titanium, shaped like a flying saucer, actual size 20 feet, and fill it with helium like a Goodyear blimp. That was just my initial reaction. Later, I came to find out that the cost is tremendous, or it doesn't look real. But the first thing Stefani wanted to know was, well, can we test these pictures? And, what labs can we get into? I'm looking at the guy, thinking, does he have any idea what he's asking? That's not equipment you go out and rent by the hour." Using contacts from his film days in Hollywood, Stefani already had begun his search for scientists, at the same time he had launched his campaign to attract investors. He later estimated he traveled to Los Angeles between 30 and 40 times, trying to interest someone in backing the film, someone who at least could finance the cost of properly analyzing the evidence. "There were a lot of things we wanted to do," he said. "And I had a fair amount of success at finding people to tell me what sort of tests should be performed. The problem was getting the people who would do them without having to spend a small fortune. Everyone I did uncover wanted a lot of dollars, we're talking maybe tens of thousands, to do testing. But I didn't have the money to do that." Stefani found himself in a catch-22, without sufficient testing having already been completed yielding positive results, it was nearly impossible to interest anyone in funding the project, and without funding, he could not hope to have the evidence tested by qualified scientists. "Once I found out that there were substantial costs involved, Stefania admitted, I really didn't push it so hard. The elders, Welch, and Stevens saw less and less of Stefania, but at the same time they began seeing more and more of Jim Dilettoso. With Stefania's project on the wane, Dilettoso, now thoroughly intrigued with the Mir story, offered to help direct Intercept's efforts in the scientific areas to interest scientists in government and university laboratories without having to pay enormous fees. To the group, Dilettoso looked and spoke like a former child prodigy who simply had become bored with school. He had attended several universities but never earned a degree, though he seemed to understand computers and had a knack for ferreting out information. Despite his Einstein hairdo and dizzy ways, they liked him. He could talk faster and better, and seemed to know more about a variety of subjects than anyone they had ever known. My first impression of Jim, said Welch, was that he seemed to have an extremely detailed mind. He was involved in creating the support behind entertainment-oriented events, the science behind it, computers, electronics, sound systems. I could tell by the way he spoke that he was very familiar with certain kinds of technical equipment, particularly in the computer field. And he was unique in one sense, he could sit down and carry on an intelligent conversation with people having different areas of expertise and hold his own in each one technically. So I thought he might be what we needed to further the investigation. After the wave of sightings around Washington, D.C., in 1952, the National Security Council ordered the Central Intelligence Agency to determine if the existence of UFOs created a danger to national security. One CIA memorandum, written August 1, stated that so long as a series of reports remains unexplainable, interplanetary aspects and alien origin not being thoroughly excluded from consideration, caution requires that intelligence continue coverage of the subject. It is strongly urged, however, that no indications of CIA interest or concern reach the press or public, in view of their probable alarmist tendencies. With influential people in Washington wanting answers, the CIA appointed a team of five eminent scientists to study the UFO problem: Dr. H. P. Robertson, from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Dr. Luis Alvarez, a physicist who 15 years later would receive the Nobel Prize for Physics, Dr. Samuel Goudsmit, an associate of Einstein from the Brookhaven National Laboratories, Dr. Thornton Page, deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Operations Research Office, and Dr. Lloyd Berkner, also of Brookhaven. Dr. Alan Hynek, the Ohio State astronomer and special consultant to Blue Book, attended selected meetings as an associate member, but was not asked to sign the final report. The group, known as the Robertson Panel, secretly convened on January 14, 1953. The first morning, they watched two color films, one taken at Dreamerton, Utah, the other at Great Falls, Montana. The films represented what Air Force Blue Book personnel considered the best evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. The Navy Photograph Interpretation Laboratory had analyzed the Dreamerton film for 1,000 hours and concluded that the 12 objects flying in loose formation could not be birds, balloons, aircraft, or reflections, and whatever they were self-luminous. But despite the Navy's findings, the panel assumed that the cinematographer, a naval commander, was probably mistaken in his estimate of how far away the objects were, that they probably were considerably closer, and that therefore, the formation of flying objects was probably nothing more than seagulls or some other kind of bird reflecting the strong desert sunlight but being just too far and too luminous to see their shape. Similarly, they dismissed the two objects in the Great Falls film as probably jet airplanes that had been seen in the area a short while before, though the man who took the footage testified he knew the difference between jets and the two objects he filmed. After viewing only 6 cases in detail and 15 cases generally, the panel concluded that nothing they had seen or heard offered scientific data of any value. The reports, while great in number, were poor in quality, and any attempt to solve them would be a tremendous waste of resources. They stated that most sightings could be reasonably explained, and that by deduction and scientific method they probably could explain all other cases as well. an aeronautical engineer, who for 15 months had served as the Air Force Project Officer for UFOs in Washington, reviewed several of the better sightings from Blue Book files for the panel and concluded that he saw only one explanation for the presence of the unusual flying objects: extraterrestrial visitation. But the panel would accept none of the cases cited by the engineer because they were raw, unevaluated reports. After a total review of approximately 12 hours, the panel concluded, "We firmly believe that there is no residuum of cases which indicates phenomena which are attributable to foreign artifacts capable of hostile acts. However, the continued emphasis on the reporting of these phenomena does, in these parlous times, result in a threat to the orderly functioning of the protective organs of the body politic." The panel was concerned that if the reports continued, the American population might be vulnerable to possible enemy psychological warfare through the cultivation of a morbid national psychology in which skillful hostile propaganda could induce hysterical behavior and harmful distrust of duly constituted authority. Among other things, the panel recommended that the two major UFO research groups, Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, in Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, and Civilian Saucer Intelligence, CSI, in New York, be watched because of their potentially great influence on mass thinking if widespread sightings should occur. The apparent irresponsibility and the possible use of such groups for subversive purposes should be kept in mind. The panel also recommended that national security agencies take immediate steps to strip the unidentified flying objects of the special status they have been given and the aura of mystery they have unfortunately acquired. Last, the panel outlined a program to educate the public to identify known objects in the sky, and to debunk the phenomenon and therefore reduce interest. The program would consult psychologists versed in mass psychology, utilize an army training film company and Walt Disney Productions, and employ famous personalities selected for their believability. The panel specifically suggested Arthur Godfrey. 12 years after he sat on the panel, Goudsmit wrote in a letter to David Michael Jacobs, author of the definitive treatise, The Controversy Over Unidentified Flying Objects in America, 1896-1973, that the subject was a complete waste of time and should be investigated by psychiatrists rather than physicists. To Goudsmit, the extraterrestrial theory was almost as dangerous to the general welfare of our unstable society as drug addiction and some other mental disorders. Dr. Hynek, the Air Force special advisor to Blue Book, who in time would evolve from a skeptic to the recognized dean of UFO study, disagreed with the panel's conclusions. They had rendered judgment in just 4 days on a phenomenon he had been studying for 4 years and still could not explain. And the more he studied, the more perplexed he became. Before Delatoso had joined their group, Stevens located a physicist in San Diego, Neil Davis, who was part owner of Design Technology, a photo-optics laboratory under contract with General Dynamics and the U.S. Navy. Though Davis could not perform the ultra-sophisticated computer image processing possible at some of the government-sponsored labs, he could quickly eliminate several possibilities of hoaxing technique or tell Stevens he was wasting his time with the photographs. Davis consented to test one color print, 3 by 4.5 inches. His conclusions, he told Stevens, would have to be preliminary because a complete and proper scientific analysis could only be conducted on an original negative. Stevens could not be sure the internegative he gave to Davis was even first generation. The photograph Stevens selected to be analyzed by Davis was of a silvery beam ship hovering approximately 150 feet off the ground near two long piles of cut and debarked pine, emerald grass and a dark green tree line, a bluish sky, and smoky hills in the distance filled the rest of the picture. Davis first examined the print under a microscope to compare the sharpness of the object with the sharpness of the scene. There is no discernible difference in image sharpness, he wrote in his report. Next, he magnified the photograph 10 times, made color separation black and white negatives, and scanned them with a microdensitometer for uniform density. Examination did not reveal any details which would cast doubt upon the authenticity of the photograph. Then, Davis carefully examined the print and his freshly made negatives for evidence of double exposure, superimposure, photo-based up, or a model at a short range suspended on a string. He wrote, "Nothing was found to indicate a hoax."